This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'd like to introduce Fielding Dawson from New York, who is going to read the stories in three sets. So I'm sure things first, and for the second set, a long story thread, which has just been published as a booklet, which is actually on sale. So if you want to buy a copy of the Bella Fitted, it's a very fine production. So this Fielding's time.
Thank you. I thought I'd begin with some older things. I had an experience with this story in New York as a starter, and it seemed to go pretty well. So I think I'll do this one now. This is called Warm Simplicity. Nazi prisoners milled in the snow and mud, waiting to be interrogated. Inside the hut, a captured Prussian officer gazed at the opposite blank wall as the American interrogation officer held the Prussian's diary open in his hand and once again asked him the meaning of a minutely scrawled sentence. "I know what the words mean, but what do they mean to you?" The enemy officer remained silent. The American officer turned several pages and, indicating the word Wieder, said, "All right, here you've written again. So that means something happened again." And the American turned a few more pages, stopping and pointing as the single words or exclamations appeared, and looking at the silent and exhausted face of the enemy officer. What interested the American was this fellow wasn't just a Nazi, he was a Prussian. These curiously dense words and phrases had appeared at intervals in 4 years of diaries, which had been interrupted by his capture, and the American officer was a little fascinated. There was an inter-contradiction, and the evasive answer lay in a simplicity exactly unknown, which seemed to glow and create a heat of its own. January 17, 1944, Ishamamish. The words occurred between 5 and 8 weeks apart. Notes of weather and troop movements had been written daily in a level style, but the exclamations occurred slanting within the lowermost corners of the printed frame for that day, now and then underlined. March 3rd, 1944. Wieder. The other man was about 5'2". He had gray hair, gray eyes, thin lips, a long nose. Unusually deep furrows spread from his nostrils to the corners of his mouth. He had escaped Hitler in a hair-raising adventure, gotten to England and then to the United States, and gladly joined the army and returned to his native Germany with American troops. The American officer asked him, "What do you think this means?" The little man faced the diary casually, but his eyes quicked over the words. Pages flew. He closed it, handed it to the American officer, saying, "His masturbation calendar." "When you do it," the little man told me, offering his experience and conviction as one gesture of love, "enjoy it. Don't rush it." Now, this is an old story as far as I'm concerned. I wrote this in, I think, 1950. I wrote this in 1955. And this is called Urbana, Illinois, and this is dedicated to Ed Dorn. And this is printed in this mimeograph sheet, which comes out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, published by one Ron Kaplan. And the name of his sheet is called Mother. I mean, that's has nothing to do with the story, but I mean, it's one of those little facts which for some senseless reason are always astonishing. But anyway, Urbana, Illinois, for Ed Dorn. They had returned from their stroll. He said, "Thank you for making me come out." She said, "I charmed you." She laughed. She rubbed her head with the towel and bent over the open door of the oven. He drank coffee watching her. "Funny, I think," he said. "What is?" how you are. Oh, do you know what I mean? I think I do. She looked at him and smiled, said, but it's different to really know me. She paused and said, I'm being brainy again. I know what you mean, I do. More than that, I think I'm funny too. I don't mean like intrigue, I mean like I am. She wrapped the towel around her head and sat down at the table with him. I want so much, she said. I want nearly all of it. That and control, and to be right. I don't like being wrong. That's not sly. It's very conscious and known. I don't have any idea what it is, but it's something I know. Only to know it all and be it all. Once I heard a woman say, and she was married and she was married and had two children, she said she imagined everyone had a secret idea they really wanted. But she made her secret idea a paradise, and it makes me laugh because that's stupid, particularly in her case, because she's a very intelligent person. Aren't those funny words, intelligent in a person? Very odd that I said them. Not like me. Perhaps it's because she said them. She leaned across the table and touched his arm. I think you're intelligent and kind. Don't forget me, please. He smiled. She went to the oven and took the towel in her fingers and rubbed it hard on her head, feeling her senses rock. The interesting lie she had just made, in sunshine. It was a real daytime lie. You couldn't lie like that at night. She took the kettle of water off the stove and waited until he put the teaspoon of instant coffee in the cup. She filled the cup, put the kettle back on the stove. He stirred the coffee with the spoon, thinking what he was doing stirring the coffee. She caught herself standing, looking blank. She glanced at him. He was watching her. He was sitting back in the wooden chair. She went to the cupboard and got a cup, came back, put it on the table, made herself some coffee, sat down and looked at him. He dropped his eyes. She rose and went to the icebox and opened it and looked inside. Would you care for something to eat? No, thanks. How had he said that? She felt everything slide away. She closed the icebox door and rubbed her forehead, pushing her fingers into the skin. She went to the table and sat down beside him. Why does it always have to be this way? What way? This. He looked at her. She looked in his eyes and put her meaning in her eyes. I don't know, he said. Drinking the coffee, she thought he was avoiding her. She clenched her teeth. She caught her breath. His lie. She stood up, but he took her wrist. Sit down. She sat down and folded her hands on the table. I am an actress. After he had gone to his class, she stacked the dishes in the cupboard and took the rag off the faucet and began wiping the table. She swept the crumbs into her hand, went around the table, and then shook the crumbs into the waste can and washed her hands, emptied the dishpan and hung the rag over the faucet, wiped her hands on the dish towel and straightened it on its rack by the edge of the sink. Then she went out onto the porch and sat down on the swing and looked at the lawn, the garden, and the street. She walked along the front walk and looked up and down the street. She went inside the house and into his room and looked over the books. She couldn't decide which. She went out of the room and out on the porch again. She sat in the big rocking chair and looked at the lawn. A bird flew to the first step and hopped up on the porch. It fluffed its feathers, spread its wings, and then stood still, looking. It tilted its head and looked at her. It looked at her, the one eye on her. She laughed to herself. Yes, I see you too. Not much later, it flew away. She knew it would. When it did, nodded. She laughed because she knew it would fly away, just as surely as it had come. Why not? The little girl, 3, from next door, came up the steps. Hello, she said to her. The little girl smiled. Come, she patted her hand. Come and sit on my lap. The little girl went to her, and she pulled her up and sat back, and pulled the little girl against her, and made the chair rock. The girl would like that. Where is your mommy? The little girl didn't answer. Is she at the store? The girl moved her head. Yes. That's very nice. And untrue. Then she leaned forward, picked the girl off her lap, and put her on the porch. You must come again. The little girl looked at her vaguely and went away. She sat back, curling her legs up, frowned, wondering. Well, she said. She got out of the chair and went inside to his room again. I will sew, she said. She laughed, looked at herself in his mirror. She sat down at the desk, opened the drawer, and took out her old lipstick, put a little on her lips, bit them together, looked in the mirror again, and put the lipstick away and closed the drawer. She washed her face in the mirror, said, I believe that is enough. Now, Charlie, have you read my story, The Invisible Glass? Have you seen that? Did you read this in Leroy's Moderns?
No.
No. Well, I'll read that then. I'll read that for you, in fact. Then I'd like to read two other stories out of this book, and then I'll go into something else. This story took me about 2.5-3 years to finish. It's called The Invisible Glass. After he married Jeanette, it was easier to let her. He went along with her. He was 30 years old, 6 feet tall, and a little fat. He had a good job, good enough. He could do better, maybe, but Jeanette was pretty. Their little home was nice. It might be she had difficulty getting things in place, pictures, furniture, that magazine table where she wanted it. She could find where she wanted it, like Joan. Joan had a wonderful sense of those drapes. Did you ever see anything like the Dick? Do you want? The car ran fine. It was, but it got him where the office where he worked was large, with bright colors and modern furniture. Richard had a desk by the window. Dick, Sally said, she was the secretary. Here's the report. Mr. Winters said, bring it in before you go to lunch. She dropped it on the desk. He glanced at it. Thanks, Sally. He looked out the window. Horace sat on the edge of the desk. Horace grinned. Good morning, friend. Richard turned. Hi. Hey, could you give me a hand with these figures? They worked it out. Richard parked the car, got out and closed and locked it and went up the walk. He saw the dog barking behind the window. He went inside, patted the animal and looked toward the kitchen. He called, I'm home. Dick, it's me. He went in the kitchen. She glanced over her shoulder and said hello. As she said hello, he crossed the kitchen to the refrigerator. She turned as he opened it. Coke? He scratched his neck, nodding, looking and finding it in the refrigerator. He took out the bottle, some ice, and made the drink. He went in the living room, sat down in his chair, and unfolded the paper. The dog barked, crossing the room to him. Dick patted the dog. The phone rang. He rose and answered it. Hello? Dick, this is Nan. Busy now? Leland and I thought maybe you'd like to come over. Wait a minute. Here's Nettie, he said, feeling Jeanette slip in behind him. He handed her the receiver, quietly saying, it's Nan. Nan, Jeanette asked, face bright. Listening, she nodded. Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask Dick. He had sat down and unfolded the paper, and was looking at the television listings. Jeanette said, Dick? He looked at her. The first martini made him giddy. Let me have some more potato chips. Dick, you're already overweight. I hate fat young men. I know, he laughed. Leland, the cheese dip. They were talking about the Jackie Gleason show. Leland was imitating that comedian, and Nan and Jeanette were egging him on. Richard sipped from the second martini and apologized. He had fallen asleep while the show had been on. Hey, where's my glass? They burst into laughter. Glass? Leland mocked. It seems to be in your hand, kind of around your drink. The other one, Richard said angrily, was right here. The girls were in hysterics. Leland chuckled. What kind of glass, Dad? They all teased him. On the way to the car, he roughhoused with Jeanette. He was glad to be outside. Jeanette laughed and told him to stop. She pushed him away. They got in the car and he felt anger and confusion. He took the wheel, raised his shoulders, raced the engine. The car lurched into the street where he stopped it. Why are we stopping? He glared out the windshield. Drive, Dick. They drove home. They had supper, watched television a while, and went to bed early. He woke feeling an urgency. He looked around the dim room, and after a moment the feeling paled and shifted into a necessity to know the time in which he was. He was ahead of himself. He had almost stopped in the middle. He looked at the clock. The indicated number said he had another hour to sleep. His heart sank and rose at the same time, hurt and delighted, and in the odd polarity he looked at Jeanette beside him, and seeing her awry in her sleep, he also saw himself and felt a strange regret, which was then halved by a necessity to move ahead and away, but to also backtrack and catalog feelings to return to the mood of the urgent awakening and figure out what was significant in a dream which he must have dreamt that had awakened him as it had. He backtracked through necessity and regret to the time in which he was, trying to figure out how the waking sensation had seemed important and why it had occurred with its particular evasive identity. And as if someone had then touched him, he distinctly remembered the waking feeling, and in the order of what was familiar to him, he felt out of place, and he tensed, knowing he would never know. He had felt the character of the dream, and now he was losing it by being aware of the self that tried to summon the self that knew. He pulled the covers around himself meaningfully, placating the safekeeping mind, which was alarmed. He felt he was dwindling, as though he had once been large and all of himself. He lay back despairing, staring out of his shrinking skull, watching running images and hearing himself breathing in a growing panic, realizing his metaphorical time of 1 hour was moving away from him, and his timekeeping consciousness flagrantly slanted into it, counting 58 minutes, 57 seconds into 58 seconds, snapping into 59, snapping into 60, 59 minutes, 1 second, snap, 2 seconds, three, going. He closed his eyes, counting, really exhausted. And then an altogether understood sense of time seemed to direct him toward the activity of busy streets, which included a superior sense of other things going on elsewhere. Possibly his time was a part of another story, as accepted as it also seemed to act out another potential, as if his longing for completion was even originally incomplete, and that dimly envisioned world seemed merely thusly X and familiar, young and old at the same time, and confounded by a painful necessity to begin quickly. Now this goes back about 4 years before. The next two stories I'm going to read are go back a few years before that. I mean, not in the sense that it but the invisible glass was the whole was the entrance, so to speak, into what it really is all about. Now Thread is like that too, but these two stories were the stories I'm going to read now were the invisible glass was, so to speak, the break from what you consider like strictly intuitional writing the invisible glass became, I became very aware of what I was talking about, and I had the problem of dealing with that, simply, you know, being aware of, being conscious of what I was doing. And earlier, in the two stories I'm going to read you now, I really had very little consciousness of what I was doing. This first story I'm going to read two stories. One is called Captain America, and the other one is called Bloodstar. And, Captain America was like, I think I wrote that on about 9 years ago. Both of these stories were about 9 years old. Captain America. Webster Groves was short and stocky, well-dressed, and his bushy mustache gave him the air of someone different, which he mildly enjoyed, and the gestures of his hands and fluidity of manner made him seem to be a plurality rather than something the avant-garde might regard as vaguely singular or parenthetical, for he seemed grateful, although he understood what that in turn might well signify. So he kept to himself, accepting the reality. He hadn't really made the team in school, and didn't pretend he had, but he could tell wonderfully amusing stories about the bench. His large mustache was a shade darker than the long, light blonde hair on his head, but it, the mustache, It was wonderful. Gave him a forward quality that kept his head up. He worked in an art supply store in downtown St. Louis and was indifferently having selling canvas tubes of paint, brushes, turpentine, stretchers, and such. Often his friends, casual or close, dropped in, quote, just to see Webster, unquote. There was something charming about him. He was 29, soft-spoken, and unpretentious. His manner held a mild flair for light-humored sarcasm. He didn't have many really close friends. Few do, certainly not in St. Louis. But those that were distinct as Webster himself was from them. They were not like him in either habit, appearance, desires, or detail. They had the quality of what friendly people really are, dull. Kirk, Ferguson, Craig, or even Manchester, Clayton, a mild-mannered, impressionistic painter who sold reasonably well, but never really got too serious, had a nice studio on the fringe of the city, and from his wide windows you could see the distant hotel chase in the park plaza above the trees overlooking Forest Park. When Webster went over to see Clayton after work, they'd smoke Clayton's favorite Cuban cigars and drink espresso in little cups and look out the window in friendly silence. And then, pleasantly bored, Webster would leave, go to Tony's, or home and eat supper, maybe take in a movie, or read, or call up Valley. Valley was tall and slender with soft, round breasts and narrow hips. Her green eyes were set far apart, and under her slightly upcurved nose, her lips were thin and soft. Her hair was dark brown and long and thin, and when let down, reached her waist. But mostly she piled it on top of her head, almost as Webster noticed, in the fashion of the Gibson girl. She was 22 and 1 inch taller than Webster and his closest friend. They got along very well. They were very much alike. She was the only real friend Webster had. They were just friends in school, and it wasn't until a few years later that he discovered and became intimate with her. He'd stop off in Maplewood and pick up a fifth of bourbon and call her up to say, "I'm coming out now." She was always there, but it always startled him when she answered the phone. Sometimes it would be days before he'd call to make the long bus ride out there. Valley lived in a made-over garage in back of a vacant lot that was really all weeds and tangled, thorny bushes full of old rubbish and rabbits and burrs. A narrow footpath ran from the corner of the street through the lot up to her door, and Webster walked it, stepped up on the log, and knocked on the door. When she opened it, he said hi and went in. She had a pleasantly messy studio, clothes on the easel and doorknobs as well as the bed and the floor. On all walls and stacked in all corners were the many varieties of surfaces she painted her little Bauhaus landscapes on. Pieces of wood, old window panes, slate, rocks, sheets of metal, etc. And even when they had been drinking one night, they went out in the lot and hauled it in, a railroad tie. She did a long, pale green and white landscape which took her 2 weeks with her palette knife. In the corner to one side of a window was a yellow icebox, and above it were red shelves with patient black Greek meanders on the edges. She went to the icebox and got out a tray of ice, took two glasses from the shelves while Webster opened a bottle. Then they began to drink. When Valley got drunk, things became larger and she more capable of handling them. Webster usually got very quiet and remained unmoved by whatever happened to be going on, but was attentive. If they got very drunk, hardly ever, they might fall asleep or gaze at each other and chatter dreamily. Or if something really ugly happened, remote chance, he'd rise and silently depart. He might not. Who knows? But as Valley became a little tighter and more expansive, Webster grew quiet and might gaze at the Feininger-like painting on the railroad tie which now hung over the little fireplace. I can wander in it forever. When they made love, she took over, and it was a quiet, passive moment in which the attenuation became a bright yellow shield of flame over her consciousness and banished her from name or face, and then became a fine and soft, warm reality of his body being in and on and later there beside her for her to caress until the time when they fell asleep, he with his fingers on her wrist, she knowing he was there beside her. Their making love was never exactly the same. They were able to lose themselves in the presence of each other, and it became what he regarded always as the one moment in his life as virtuously invisible as the palpable sense of despair real as the act for it always followed, like an unknown soldier or a dusty shadow or introspective deja vu. With his fingers touching her wrist, he'd lie there listening to her breathing regularly and almost see and hear the footfall of something as wide as all space and long as all time. A shadow like the pale mother in a jar of vinegar, only this. Spread over the imaginative face of his seeing existence. Singing a song in a prehistoric language. A long, unending tune of death, loneliness, despair, forever. Valley was forever. And when he went to see her, he knew he was literally walking across the field into the valley of eternity, forever. Death in a sequence of no pattern at all. She was like a magic place, a glade, within the great fulcrum of the universe. He knew it, knew that, and knowingly entered it. It was like walking into an invisible dimension and losing himself. In that world, in that room, in that bed, in that woman and without identity. Her universe. Deeply burrowed in that circular thing underneath, he was afraid. During breakfast the next morning, they ate and drank coffee in silence. And if they didn't go for a walk, or she didn't make some drawings of him, or they didn't listen to the radio or read or talk, he would leave her. Dazed, he walked out of the door and across the vacant lot to the street. The sunny day. Back now in the world again to sell tubes of paint and talk with people, read and maybe go to a movie alone or with friends, or simply be and listen to the ideas and noises of life in the city, to go to sleep, wait for the return, the inevitable scent in time and space, to carry him across the vacant lot to that little house of hers. That was what that was. He counted on it, but never tried to make it be. It was right. There. Wherever he was, whatever he was doing, whenever the great anything happened, he knew her reality existed within it, identically off from him, for him, never waiting, but always there, eternal. It occurred. Then, anywhere, anytime, no matter what was going on, the reality of Valley would appear into his life in substantial form, like the dream sound of a distant trumpet call, clear and keen, existent but untouchable, she beckoned. So now, at work, on a bus, home in bed, at a movie, a party, out walking, or while over in Clayton's studio, smoking those Cuban cigars, drinking espresso and looking out the windows at the Park Plaza Hotel, something from outside himself between which he saw nothing, off from himself spanned the space and distance like a bridge, like a weird reflection bridge from out of a prism, magic and shimmering, came to his eye, and within the invisible glitter a form appeared to make whatever he was doing cease to exist. And rather than quickly phone her, he woke slowly, let her fill the air so when he called, it would be his hand on the instrument and his lips speaking words and the reality of her voice surprising him because all the rest was already fulfilled and what remained to be done was. So he walked and talked, acted and gestured, spoke mildly of school or art, letting the sound of her flesh fill him, slowly, on wings, until he was blindly on his way to her. Then there was no time. The distance between himself and Valley did not exist. He bought a bottle. The bus ride was accomplished, and he walked across the vacant lot on the footpath to her front door as the nearing sea of her reality rose to drown his identity. Gone when, after he knocked, she opened the door, he said, "Hi," and went in. She broke ice cubes into glasses while he opened the bottle. They drank and talked, and she became expansive, and he listened. Then they made love, and then she fell asleep, he with his fingers touching her wrist, she with the knowing sense that Webster was there beside her, he listening to her breathing regularly and wondering if it might come from another thing, the thing from the old world, or a more knowing world with a dream sound of a distant trumpet call and the invisible presence of the unknown soldier with the flesh and blood, the universe, the stuff of reality within which men and women existed, the hum, like the hum of doom, of despair and loneliness and death, the language of an unknown man who fell on an unknown field in an uncharted time. This is called Blood Star. One word. You bet. Not till Tuesday. Okay. He hung up, stepped out of the telephone booth. One. He sat at the bar and thought. Thoughts and images. Her guitar and singing voice. Embraces all the rest. In importance, in fact. That need not lead to other facts. That did lead to other facts. Get receptive. Stuck there like a burr in your hair. Maybe it was most of her. There's a fact. The bartender put the beer in front of him. He paid. Lesbians. After the Kodachrome photographs, on the Swiss Alps, skiing with a handsome man, sun sparkling on snow-white, red ski clothes, snow, gleaming accoutrements. On the Caribbean with another fellow on a yacht, glistening, spanking white, bright green stripes, colored flags. Along the beach in Nice, arms linked with another man's, running into the water laughing, hair flying behind her tan body, photographs in color, blonde hair blonde, golden body golden, white rim above white breasts, white line around white waist, between white thighs, white line of sea foam, flurry of waves, silver white beach, dazzling in that sun, blue ultramarine, blue green sea, invisible winds, soft sweep across flesh, water, earth, photographs, color, sound, hold it, great, another, laughter, they kiss. Hey, take one of me like that. Two men trade places, and he kisses her as the other shoots. Then they lift and carry her wiggling body into the sea. We're passed around, held against the light of the lamp on the table. She stood up, finished her glass of beer, and touched the snoot of the police dog who rose with her. She passed into the other room. He refilled her glass, his own, and the beautiful girlfriend's glass, while she sat at the other end of the table, handsomely sullen in the glare of the lamp as the shade had been tipped, the light flayed out. Fix the shade, why don't you? Okay. He straightened it, and they waited in silence, drank beer. She returned to the room with her guitar and sat down. She took a drink. She tightened the strings, tested their tone. Finally, she began to sing. 3 years before, when he had been in school, he received a letter one afternoon. It read, "My dear sweet friend, I have met the most beautiful woman you could see. If you ever come to New York, I want you to meet and know her. I have told her very much about you. When you come, phone. If I had a flower, a violet, I would send it to you. However, it is winter in New York and bitter cold. There are no flowers. There is hope. I have found hope. I send some of my hope to you, a gentle hug, a small kiss." Time passed. "Sure, it's late. Yes, of course I'm drunk." "No, I don't have a job." "You do? In 45 minutes? Just time enough." "Yes, me. I want some hope, too." "Never mind. Too long ago." "Sure, I understand. Tomorrow. Okay. Tell your beauty hello." "Years. Right. No. Army. Kilmer. Till Sunday evening. At noon? Tomorrow at noon. Right. Promise. Carney Taylor." "Nice, yes, see you." He came down Broadway in the early morning snow. It was near 8. He crossed Union Square and later 14th Street, headed down University Place towards the bar. AWOL bag in his hand, and dressed as he was in the olive drab of the U.S. Army, in 1 month, Germany. The Atlantic Ocean crossing, February 1954. But his feet were getting wet. GI low quarters weren't made for snow. He crossed 13th, looking in a bar with a glance, seeing opening preparations just as the clock struck 8 in the churches, on 5th Avenue, 12th Street, 10th Street and Broadway. 8 o'clock, up too early, a mild hangover. The snow felt good. He leaned his head back and closed his eyes, letting the flakes hit his face. Tuesday, 2 years later, he called her. "Yes, Miss Taylor, fourth floor, you will? Thanks." "Yes, Miss Taylor, fourth floor, you will? Thanks." He lit a cigarette in the phone booth and waited. The receiver in his left hand, he watched the bartender serve a man a beer. His own stood on the bar waiting for him. "Miss Taylor." "Carney, I'd like a large hope chest." "You, how are you? Are you out now?" They talked about Europe, things in common, and even got a little loaded at lunchtime. She confessed she was high and didn't know how she would finish out the rest of the day. He realized as she talked, "I put in my life. Without photographs, Over the rim of my friendly glass, I see you. He laughed out loud. A puzzled look came over her face. She had been explaining her job to him. What is it? She asked. Nothing, he said. Nothing? Tell me. I'd like to share it with you. No, he said. I'll tell you something, though. I'll tell you a story about Germany. It's to the point. I'd like to hear it, she said. I met a girl in Heidelberg who was bright and attractive, he began, sitting back in the chair, offering her a cigarette. She took it. He took one for himself, both of which he lit. He exhaled, and in the smoke, even in the eyes, but like a clouded or filmy thing, just behind the front transparent part that I took to be withdrawal at first, from lack of confidence, all of which was true enough. But as it later turned out, you could never be sure about what is something else when you first encounter it. So she was full of doubt. You want to go faster? We talked, walked, drove, danced, and laughed around Heidelberg. She had an old yellow Mercedes convertible, which could scarcely run, but which we drove everywhere. So what was it? I kept asking myself, that thing, like a burr in your hair, a nettle, refusing to let loose of you. She asked if I believe in the stars telling things. We were out walking then, one night, up near the Schloss, the castle, and there was a tall stone tower which rose into the dark sky. When she was a girl, one night she had wandered into the tower, gone up the circular flight of stone steps to the top, come through a trap door, and there, in the tiny circular topmost cubicle, was a giant man, beard darker than night, and as thick as hands clung to his jaw, eyes like luminous blades, revolving, slowly whirring, covering her. He did drawings of her, told her of her past, of a sunny day in Rotterdam when she had gotten on a streetcar, of her future, of the art and magic of the universe, and revolving galaxies spangled with stars like all-seeing eyes. When she returned the next night, he was not there. She returned again and again to the old tower, but he had vanished. Years passed. She grew up. The war came, and she idolized Nazi flyers like Americans idolize movie stars. Every German girl kept photographs. When the war was over, she went to Belgium, rented a room in a boarding house. She met a woman of her age. They became fast friends. They swore in blood to always love the other. It was in the stars for them. They separated for a time. She returned to Heidelberg. What was it, she kept asking herself, about this woman that so fascinated her? One day, she passed the tower. Suddenly, she knew. She knew. She wrote her friend, told her everything. The friend wrote back. They were to meet in Berlin. She went gladly, her heart happy in anticipation. They made plans. She had known an old friend in Dresden, and they would go, an adventure into communist Germany. They went to Dresden. The friend was gone. The city was in ruins, streets bare, skies gray, overcast. Russian soldiers paced guard in their ugly and unkempt uniforms. The two women wandered over the city, exploring the ruins. They discovered a restaurant she had known as a child, long before the war. They went in, sat at a booth. The waiter came and they ordered. The waiter said they could go in back if they wished. What is this? They asked each other. They went in the back. The room was bathed in blood-red light. Couples danced to cool American jazz records. Moving figures, faces and shadows were murky red forms. They sat at a table. A woman approached them, sat down and smiled, and other women joined them, talked in many languages and drank with them. Across the room, through red smoke, over the rows of liquor bottles and large purple mirrors behind the bar, a mask hung on the wall, a glass mask whose blood-red, star-shaped eyes bubbled. Under the mask, red neon said, Blutstern. A decade later, she ascended the long flight of steps to the Heidelberg Schloss for the last night of Fasching Festival, she in costume, a princess in her gown. It was late, approaching midnight. At midnight, the queen of Fasching would be chosen. The party would last all this night as it had lasted for 4 days. As she went up the dark steps, she noticed a figure descending far above. A shadow had moved. It is nothing, she told herself. Someone coming home early from the party. The figure came closer. They met. A hand took her arm, and the voice apprehensively questioned, Dresden? And the eyes glowed and whirred like bloody stars and revolving blades, and the beard darker than night. The beard like claws on a jaw moved as the voice repeated, Dresden, like a wind come clanging out of the craters of the moon. Dresden, Dresden, Dresden. more in this, which will end this set. I think that the things that writers like best are not necessarily those which, first of all, are best, and the things that are like accepted or something as best, something like that. That's that kind of thing. But this is a story that that I love, and it's called The Highwayman. And this is for Tonio, I spell it here, Kroger, bitterly. And this is for that Tonio Kroger guy like out of Thomas Mann. This is who that's dedicated to. He sat across the table from her. They drank, smoked, talked. To the right of his plate was a little package, white paper and light blue ribbon. A card was tucked under the bow. Supper was delicious, the rare steak supreme. Fresh, piping hot string beans and fluffy mashed potatoes were wonderful, and the after-supper coffee was superb. She rose from the table and went in the kitchen, returned with a small round cake in her hands, and her face was angelic in the candle glow. She put it in front of him and told him to make a wish. "May I tell you?" "No, it won't come true," she said. "Blow them out." He blew them out, and she helped him take the candles out, and he cut two small slices. "Open your present," she said. He read the card. "Happy birthday, my darling," she said. It was what the card said. He smiled and opened the package, not tearing the paper or spoiling the ribbon. It was a lovely edition of Joyce's chamber music. "Lean out of the window, golden hair. I heard you singing a merry air." "Thank you, sweetheart," he smiled. His eyes were bright. He read the poems to her while she did the dishes. After that, they locked up the house and drove down the street towards the highway to St. Louis. The movie was clever and relaxing, and afterwards they had a few drinks in a favorite tavern. The drive home was lovely. Early summer nights are beautiful in Missouri. "It seems like the air is humming," she said. The wind rushed through her hair, and she spread her arms high and wide and brought them down in a windy laugh. "How happy I am." The stars were bright and high and far away. She looked up at them. "Do you think there is noise in the universe?" "Sure," he said. "I mean, without any reason, just noise, you know?" "Mm-hmm." "I'm in love, I guess that's it." He didn't reply. "It must be terrible if you're lonely." "It is." "Were you lonely before you had me?" "Yes," he said. "Are you now?" He smiled. "No." "Are you happy?" "Yes." "Just yes? Nothing sensational?" "Yes." "Is that all you can say?" "Yes," he smiled. The car glided around a long turn, and a distant bridge loomed up. They shot under, and it slid away behind him like a great stone dog. They turned in the driveway. He opened the garage door and drove in. She got out. She went in the house. He pulled down the garage door and she called out from the kitchen. "Would you care for a nightcap?" He looked up. He locked the door and dusted his hands. "Very much." "What?" "Rye and soda." "Okay." "Do you want to watch TV?" "No." "You?" "Not if you don't." "Fine, we won't." "Do you think I'll ever be as old as you are?" "Not at the same time." Her laughter was lovely, and as she sipped her drink, she looked over the rim at him. "I love you," she said. He turned the glass around in his hands and looked into it, watching the cube stay in the same place. She lowered her drink. "I was cruel to you, talking like I did in the car." "No, you weren't," he said. "It can't be helped." "Will you tell me about her again?" "Will you tell me about her again?" He turned on the sofa and looked at her and smiled. "Your voice is like your mother's," he said. "And when you said you loved me, it was her again." "Did she say it often?" "Not very." "Are you still in love with her?" "More with the dream, darling, the way I'd want her." "May I ask what way?" "Sure, she's beautiful. I'd like her to be as beautiful as she is." "Change of subject," she smiled. "Bob and I are getting married next year, and what will you do?" "I don't know," he said. He cleared his throat and finished his drink. When she returned, she asked him as she handed him his drink, "May I ask you something personal?" He answered the personal question. "I don't know if I'll marry again. Probably not. And yes, there is a woman. I hear an army charging out of the sea," she quoted. She recited it all. It was the last poem of chamber music. "My love, my love, my love, why have you left me alone?" There was a pause. "Did you like that?" "Very much." "Why do people fall out of love?" "I don't know. They do." "Why were you and mother divorced?" "Well, there were problems." "What kind? Please, I want to know." He raised his eyebrows and sighed. "There were sexual difficulties, and that's..." "What kind of difficulties?" He looked at her pointedly, not unkindly. "She remained aloof, took a distance from me. She wouldn't come to me." "I see, I guess." She looked at the floor. Then she ran her hand through her hair. Bob likes you very much, if it helps. I like him, too. Do you think we'll be happy? I'm sure of it. You are? You've inherited, that is true, your mother's beauty, and I hope some of my best qualities. Bob seems sure of himself, and that's important. He wants to make his life his own, and you fall into that. That's very good. Your mother would never include herself in my life. We've fought over that. She likes being a wife, but wouldn't accept me. I think a woman is only happy when she is within the life ring of her man. I love you so much. He smiled. Well, he said, why don't you have another drink? May I? Of course. You're how old now? 22. Then have a couple. She made the drink and returned. Have you seen Mother since last time? He sighed. I did. It was strange. No, not strange. I saw her drive by. I was coming out of the office onto the street. She drove by. Did she see you? Yes. As I watched her, she turned. Our eyes held for a time, and she smiled and waved. Then she was gone. And you were in love with her all over again. He sighed quietly, nodded his head, and sipped a drink. I sure was. My golden ex-wife. He looked in his daughter's eyes. She said, do I look like her? Yes, but more. That must be something. Her pictures are terrific. There was a lull when he finished his drink. Would you like another? She asked quietly. No, I think I'm going to bed. I'm very tired. He stood up and smiled. You can stay up. Finish your drink. Have another. Leave the things out. Cleo will clean up in the morning. Okay. Good night, sweetheart. Good night, Daddy. I hope you had a nice birthday. He turned in the doorway and came to her, kissed her forehead. I did. I had a wonderful time. She turned on the radio and put her feet up on the coffee table, lit a cigarette and lay her head back, listening to the quiet dance music and letting her thoughts go free. It was like a movie with dimension and another sound, a throb, a fierce hum, like the mandolin passage in Bartok's Sixth Quartet or a wind or James Joyce. She snubbed out the cigarette and finished the drink, yawned, and lay her head back again, and the moving reel of vision unwound around her mind like gauze around the brain. The future with Bob was bright and real, and she felt she could hear his voice. He wasn't speaking, but it was his voice. Her father appeared before her, walking as he walked every day, and his phantom loneliness seemed to make her sympathetic, wise, and womanly. She felt and saw her life rise before her almost in awe of itself, and there was that music, too, of her oncoming life, superimposed over the giant outline of the great mystery of her mother. Did James Joyce know her mother? The drawing of him by Wyndham Lewis took shape and spoke of the translated ex-wife. The words, her father's voice rose into the volume of her vision pronouncing, the life you are about to lead. A silhouette against the first streaks of dawn. Then he began down the highway. The credits read like an unusual verse line. Their meaning was hard to understand, but now they were over. The plot was taking shape. Now, this piece that I'm going to read in this, the second set, like they say, is a long piece. Now, evidently in the first piece I read much, I didn't realize that it was going on so long, but so that's the way it is, that's the way that is. But this one is a long and solid prose piece. I'm going to wait until that's all that's done. Would you tell me when I can go, Nina? Water. What a strange day. Is it okay now? This is called Thread. Long story in there.
There it is. I got it.
I have green eyes. I sit at the table nervously listening to them. I am watching myself listening and looking. I am telling myself to pay attention. See and listen and not see and listen. My hair is a little gray. A woman walks in me. She pays no heed. I sit here and listen and look. I am myself. The others sit around me and talk. I am tired. I have not worked hard today. I am drinking. I am confused. I am restless, and my mind is on other things. I am interested. I am an interesting man. I interest myself. I reached for her in the distance behind her green eyes. She stood behind the mask of her beautiful flesh. In through her eyes I went, reaching for the distant visible woman. I was clear, hard, etc. I listen to them. They are talking about dogs. A dog lies on the floor beside me. A cat is on the windowsill behind the refrigerator. The man gestures across the table. He is talking about movie stars. Garbo, he says. He doesn't understand how anyone cannot see Garbo. He says he confused the Gish sisters. The homely one was the one he spoke to, meaning to speak to the pretty. I am neither slowly nor rapidly revolving within insanity. My mind confuses my feelings. My powers of interpretation fail me. My sense for sequence is passé, and I fear what's ahead. I am going into darkness. I hear them still talking, yet I am nervous in a current. I gather myself in an interest, but I am far from myself. I am on a train. I am in darkness every moment, every day, near the farness and nearness of myself and oblivion. A thin man beside me is slightly bald. Dog leash around his fist. We are talking about dogs. Until I got the job I contribute, I hadn't understood so many. Where do I work? Joey Brown asks from across the table. I say I work at. His eyebrows go up. The dog chases the cat. Joey Brown throws his hands in the air. Pardon him for being queer, but he doesn't think dogs are supposed to like cats. Joey Brown bursts out of his mouth. Someone rises. I smile. I chuckle. I laugh. I grin. I mutter. Someone says dogs aren't like they used to. I am self-conscious. I see my wife looking at Joe E. Brown, talking to her. She sees, she listens to him and looks at him, and in her turn nods and responds and sees and hears. She smokes a cigarette. She is a little earthly, ancient. She is not me. She looks at him. She is moving outward in perception. She sorts through his face, behind his face, and hears his running, mindless meanings. I am sent into myself and her as she is in me. She lives in me. She lives in me. I am sent into myself. I lay my naked face on her naked chest and came out from within my head and adored her. And my responsive heart banged against, and her responsive heart banged against my face last night. Now she has stepped into that chair, and I yet feel her sound and touch her feminine message pounding through her important life. I want you to meet me, otherwise I am Joe E. Brown. You are reading Self-Consciousness and Emotion. Myself, the pale and pretty girl says, after she looked at me for answers and I gave them, my friend, the host of this party, asked her why she had looked away, and she lied. She had looked at me for an answer. The writer writes into the dialogue of the world, she says. The writer writes the dialogue of the self in the self into the dialogue of the world. I insist on separating accumulated perceptions. No synthesis. And she agrees. I say I overcomplicate things. She looks at me. I look at her and know her complicated need for her within and away from someone else. Love and fear, the shadowy fearing self in her flesh without resilience. I see in darkness. I see her eyes, her bright strike of perception. I say to her, I hear you and like it. I like you, I say. I love the sense of her. She pays no heed. And I love and know her, green in my eyes. Don't leave me, she says. She sees and knows she is lonely, that he whom she perceives should appear before her complicated in her voice, quote him, unquote, him. Her own dark eyes, pale face, her face is drawn, she has razor dimples and thin nostrils, the temples are nearly transparent, and as she speaks of Russian men, her face hardens, her nostrils move, her teeth set, her eyes flash, and she invisibly goes into his arms in conflict and perception against the wall of windows and night. She at my side as I cast my experiences ahead of myself, beside her, moving endlessly forward, tell me a story once again and again, and then again I encounter myself in the shifting constructions of the selves of myself within turmoil. the man or woman on the streets of a novel or the writer and his world pattern within him. She asks, what if it's true? Cars crash. When you write it, I answer, change it. Tell me a story, she says. I continue to what it means as it is familiar, like world cars, and world people, us, I grin. Self-conscious, she is interested, she says, tell me. Two highways spread towards her, one sexually incapably bright and unending, the other sexually incapable and immediately disastrous, lonely and regretful. I met him at a little get-together at Odie's house, I begin. We were drunk in her kitchen. He shot the Nazis as they came over the rise, one by one, he said, as they came over, and they kept coming. I kept shooting, and then they stopped coming. There were tears in his eyes. He gnashed his teeth. He bit his lip. My green eyes were contemptuous. He saw them and accepted the look. He was a rich young artist, a big man with big shoulders and big hands. He had stiff, light brown, short-cut hair, and perspiration spotted his skull, giving him a hectic look. He gave me a dirty look. He glowered. Had I ever been in war? No, I didn't know anything about death, he said. We were in the living room looking and talking at each other, and Odie's high-waisted daughter sat in the big artist's lap as Odie talked about the art critic for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a good man, a little naive. And a few weeks later, having nothing to do, I walked across town to a new suburban development where the rich young artist lived. I went in through the gates passing a ranch house on a hill where the DJ for radio station WIL lived, and I went around the bend up to the street to the artist's house. I buzzed the new buzzer, and his wife answered. She had indeed spotted me at Odie's. Odie introduced me as a young writer from around the corner who couldn't make up his mind whether to stay in St. Louis or go to New York where his friend Franz Klein lived. I said I would go to New York. I didn't know when. And the artist's wife, happily contemptuous, watched me become resentful. His wife said her husband was busy in the studio. She stood behind the closely woven copper screen and smiled. The corners of her painted lips moved up her face, and her eyes went flat. I heard an ice tray pop in his voice. Who was there? Invisible teeth appeared behind her felled lips. She opened the door over her shoulder, describing the young writer at Odie's. I went in. He shook my hand, avoiding my eyes. I looked into his to pester him. I had nothing to do, I said. So I thought I'd visit. She walks in me. She guides me. We crossed the court floor and sat on a long foam rubber studio couch in St. Louis earth-colored batik. His paintings hung on the walls around the house. We began to talk. His wife sat across the room. She was petite with big hips. Her pleated skirt hung down her shin bones, sweeping in her feminine walk. She had smooth skin. Her grin was sharp up her enthusiastic face, facing me obliquely from a little behind herself, feet flat, another face, a shark's face, set in possession, jealousy, anger, and apprehension. She glittered her role in his life, and he blended and sat back affluently, a successful artist, young with a great future in her skyscraper eye. He was leaning against himself as he had leaned toward and painted the young boys with idealistic expressions and dark, flat, empty eyes, which yet held an inner unpainted glitter, a chemical and fantastic radiance on the painted face of the painted boy, gazing beyond his outstretched hands, entwined in a construction of string against a wall of crisscrossed twine. Later, the wealthy artist and I walked down the sloping backyard, his wife in the front, eyes burning over the grass, setting up a charged field around him, one touch, instant death. He seemed glad to get out of the house. I wanted to possess, influence, and pester and touch him. I could touch myself, I couldn't possess me. And in a while, I a little stole him and understood him as he wandered in himself, so aimless, distracted, young, lonely, haunted by the quick step from a vivid gutter to bewildering fame. We sat on large rocks and chattered like two lovers. I felt sentimental. I had already become the part of me which was him, and he still him. So I told him a story about a girl in New York, and I left the story unfinished. After she threw it to me, I looked at it lying in the palm of my hand and then looked up at her, and in the terrific glitter of her eyes, I did understand that in the way I had turned into her, we plotted a murder and it failed. She confessed she was glad. I was too. I didn't mind killing myself. I had killed me all my life, but to kill someone else, to strengthen the feminine bridge between myself and the girl I had become confused me, and I omitted that mystery, keeping my eyes on his, telling him of the young man on the tarot card who holds a large tilted figure eight, and in each loop of the eight a world circle, and in the center of each circle a star, one of energy, the other of violence. Two ships crossed the ocean at my feet. I was the young man, she interpreted. I was holding the opposite worlds where I was, a double destiny, while world ships went their way as they would continue to go, being there meaningfully for me to board. She lived on the Lower East Side in a railroad flat, and one narrow rear room was divided almost in half by a table against one wall. Two barrels supported a long sheet of plywood on which lay small collections of numbers, buttons, letters, pins, cloth, clothes, books, boxes, shoestrings, clothespins, and photographs, all of which I looked at while she went into a corner. She took a little box from beneath the crumpled cloth and crossed the room towards me. She stopped. She opened the box with her head down, giving me a level up from under look. She unfolded tissue paper, reached inside, and took out a toy gun and pointed it at me, raising her head, holding her eyes on mine. She put the box on the table, and then simply standing, looking in my eyes with a gun in her hand. She was a beautiful girl. Her hair framed her oval face, and her eyes looked in mine until I saw she was changing behind her face. She smiled. Her figure seemed to straighten and float. I saw her breasts rise and fall. I was aware of her hips, her shoulders, her legs, her power in her flesh. I then saw she was distant from me. I grinned. I dropped the grin. She was distant from herself. My ears picked up the noises of the city. I saw the muscles in her forearm change, the bones in her hand set. She was clenching the gun and squeezing the trigger. For an instant, I saw a darkness spread, and like a dark cloud on the horizon, sweep forward towards her eyes. I was alive, vivid. She pulled the trigger. I stepped forward, and the rich young artist threw his hands in the air. She tossed the gun to me. I threw it to him. "No," he cried, stumbling backward, arms over his face. "We have a drink. Our glasses touch. I am tangential and aware. You said turmoil. I sit here nervously with my drink in my hand, wanting to say the familiar variety of opposites in inner constructions, in inner turmoil, in the inner world, darkest of all, frightening, invisible, a turmoil to become. It is more real than this, which is an integral and momentary part of us." "That's good," she says. "I say you are history. As you speak, I hear you now. Self-consciousness rises and envelops me. We, this glass, are. I am lonely for myself. I rise, I fade from the end of my story towards my friend, the host, to get a drink. I stand at the bar, kitchen counter while he makes a drink. I make a joke. At the end of the movie, he gets on the bus and goes away, but he will come back. Children have fallen in love with him. So has Ida Lupino in my life. They are all him, and he is her, and them, and he takes leave of himself, repeatedly entering the forward-moving stream of his lives. I am in a different chair, and my wife is talking with the pale, dark-haired woman whose eyes flash when she speaks of Russian men. I have told of my life. I have departed from it into it, and I am nervous. I cross and uncross my legs. I shuffle my feet. I squirm in my chair. My host glances at and sees his me. He would call me his friend. "It is up to us," he said when Klein died. He has said many things to me as I to him from first college days, and by entering my mind, I have split and shattered me. There are many roads to follow and many lives to be. I follow them. I am different from other men only in the hunger for unity within inner frenzy. And I am angry that he befriends me in the way I am his friend by him. By me, we are each other's experience and fate, friends. In his consideration, the roads lead to deductions, answers, and opinions, and I follow them obediently all at once to him or not to him as he sees me. I would call him us before I would call him my friend. I love him, not our friendship. He separates himself from me in thought and contemplation, and he sees his me. And in his thought, I become myself as he perceives me. He blends his deductions with his attitude, which omits me. But this deductive attitude is him, is his personal moral development, is his style of being sentimental, self-pitying, and ridiculously in love with himself. Detective, lover of deadly goddesses, world of experience within a world of thwarted experience. He carries himself with a tough sense of humor and an attitude of deductive knowing. The Witches. An old friend of mine wrote a book about two married couples, but I did not think my friend had learned about himself from his experiences, which made his novel an acidly angry narrative. The frenzied rage of himself, blinded by his memory of jealousy and desire and fear and failure, in a representation of sections of memory, not as they changed and or influenced him, but as he reacted to his failure to follow any initial reaction that made it memorable. There is a realization of adultery in the book which changes into the vehemence he reveals by denying true action. But as he fails to follow any initial reaction, he uses his protagonist to represent reality. He remembered the memories and overlooked the causes. The causes make fiction nearly unwritable. His hair seems longer. He rather stoops. His chin stretches tightly over the bones on his face, neck. His blouse bags forward, and I see his scrawny chest and shoulders. His lips are drawn back and his teeth are bared and smeared with blood and lipstick. He will kill his experience in his life, and as his killing goes on, he will naturally reach out to kill me, include me. You can't change anything by intention, he wisely said. I asked, where were you 10 years ago, and I was concerned with that. I was right here, he said metaphorically. You were no help then, I said. He reached across the table. Look, he said tenderly. And a man appeared beside him, looking intently at me. The other said, I care for you, do you know that? Which does? He pointed to his chest and underlined, I do. I nodded. I had just seen him appear apart from himself. Which cared? The one there or that one? That frenzied hag in him didn't. She wrote a book about what she cared about. She loved him, loved to hurt him, and to haunt him with disaster and loneliness. If it was up to her, she would change the world. It had been her intention from the start. And she looked gravely at me as I said to her, I battled the compulsion of intention for 10 years. I and all my selves, including my witch, intend to change the world. Now I intend to change into all I was. And I battled the compulsion of intention for 10 years. I and all my selves, including my witch, intended to change the world. Now I intend to change into all I was and am. He stepped into the one to his left and nodded drunkenly. She rubbed her hand across her mouth and drew blood. And the face of flesh which identified the man I once knew was my friend, one out of several faces of his own that did care for me, looked a little hauntedly at me, as if he was seeing us together in a photograph, laughing and loving each other a long time ago, and was now condescending to me. You'll make it, he said. Yet that strange, tall child, clinging grimly to him for him, as if he was his own son and father of same, hated and feared and loved and needed, and his face became a complicated and brilliant hostility. But looking at himself, he thought he was one man. I despise my self-conscious witchiness, my wary and defensive reaction to my host at this party. In him, as I would build a historical fiction of him, I see Juarez versus Maximilian von Habsburg, as John Huston made it. Maximilian's wife Carlotta could not have children. She stopped herself and turned into his Mexico and the adoption of one who would one day rule Mexico in the Habsburg tradition. Juarez had been double-crossed by one of his generals, who seized a shipment of arms from the United States, and Juarez was in peril. The United States warned Napoleon III that Maximilian's reign violated the Monroe Doctrine, that the U.S. recognized the government of Juarez, not that of Maximilian. The U.S. was ready to go to war with Napoleon. Napoleon withdrew his armies from Mexico, just as Maximilian had Juarez were wiped out. Maximilian then discovered Napoleon had sent him to Mexico as puppet, which enraged Maximilian, and Carlotta sailed to France and threatened to expose Napoleon to the world. She suffered a mental breakdown. Juarez killed the generals who double-crossed him, gathered his armies and swept towards Maximilian. Maximilian's general told Maximilian to flee. Maximilian would not. He received word of his wife's condition, dissolved his palace guard, and made preparations to flee. As Juarez troops were at the palace gates, Maximilian changed his mind. He stayed to fight, was captured, put in jail. Carlotta sat in a high-backed chair facing Austria through open doors in sun and mist, silent and still in that arched, high-ceilinged chamber of insanity, and rose from her chair. She fled out the door, screaming his name. He came over the rise, the men with guns behind him, the figure of Carlotta all over him. Me too, as I see me standing in our driveway, 10 years old in Missouri. Our dark brown hair and white flesh, a pretty girl with flashing eyes, watched the children play across the street. I was new there. I was 8 years old. They looked at me. They gradually stopped playing. I crossed the street. I joined them on their side of their street, of my future street, of my hometown. Later, I wrote from my college to G that I loved him sexually. I desired his flesh. His reply ended a companionship of separate destinies begun from across the street. I had always, through high school and college, envisioned him older. He was younger. I wanted to possess and influence him as I would me. I did not possess me or influence me. He seemed older, more decisive. He turned me into me, turning me into a little girl. Yet in world life we grew older, influencing each other. I desired he separate himself from his father, and he argued I wanted to possess him as if I was father. He was brilliant that night. I was objectively respectful but jealous that he saw me so well. And then, a year later, I wrote him for his flesh. And a year after that, I saw him at a hometown wedding and spoke to him. His word was hello. His eyes stated his certainty of self, a gulf between my self-consciousness and me. Later, a few days before I was drafted, I met him on the street, and we walked hostile blocks to the main street of town where we parted, and I was gone, falling in step with my life and our unified, separate destinies, which keeps my reaction to him and my reaction to my experiences as I react to me in outer and inner worlds. My letter parted us for us to never part. I was far from myself. I touched him to bring my inductive influence into view via him into me. I saw our childhood play. I pushed him places in a baby buggy tank in our artillery games down streets. Through yards I pushed, gazing, radiating down on him, older, decades older. I was, in a nearly tragic sense, of mother, yet feeling like a little girl boy as I pushed, leaning over G. Mother, brother, sister, lover, friend, student, teacher, envier, in every billion-cornered day, saturated with existence, reaching into an idea of words in a letter that went out with rightness a la serendipity, which he read, they said, they read, I loved him, the hymnus of him, I was starving for me, too late. The words were, I want you, just as he read them, to him sexually. I remember Fatty. I remember Fatty was funny with girls, so I felt to save him and me, me and me. Sorry for him, me. I pulled him across the street to the rest of the gang to play airplanes. His fat face pouted, his double chin doubled, the tips of his ears pointed above his chubby neck, and his high voice protested he didn't want. I took Tug in, the other kids looked. I said, he's mine. He's going to play with us. Fatty didn't want to. He took the model ME-109 in his hand, but couldn't bring it across the field. And I said no, and I told him how to hold the plane. Later we played football and he cried. I knelt beside him, and later I walked him to Kirkwood Road. His eyes were dark, his eyebrows arched, he powdered, he kept pushing me away. I pulled him on, I told him how to hold the plane. When you get shot down, I said, wetting the kitchen match, you do this. I struck the match on the sidewalk and held it against the fuselage on the side of the cowling. It smoked. The plane had been hit, its engine smoking. It winged over with G's Spitfire following it towards the trees, firing short bursts again and again, then banking off toward the lizard's tanks, which crossed the tennis court. See, I said. The Messerschmitt ripped to oblivion at the base of the tree. Fatty looked at me, distracted and frightened. I came around end and fired the pass. He missed it. I walked him to Kirkwood Road as he wept. I comforted him. His hands and arms had gone into the air, fluttered for the ball, missed. He hated me for bringing him. He crossed Kirkwood Road and went home. I stood on the corner and watched him, my hand holding my hair, my skirt. Asleep 20 years later in a kitchen like the kitchen in the Episcopal parish house or the one in the army mess hall in Germany, I was standing at the other end of the cutting table from G. "What is it?" my wife asks. I open my eyes and look across our loft home. He came slanting around the corner of in an angular caricature of a small western town. We looked down and saw him chase G around corners of the Hollywood cow town. G fled around a corner and the other man bent over as if to merge with himself, emerged from himself, and putting on hat and pants, he stepped on stilts as Uncle Sam, disguised in striped pants, studied himself, rose up to me very close, and lurched around the corner after G with the quality of thunder and understanding. We were afraid as he bent forward and elongated, tall Uncle Sam pursued G. Uncle Sam's hands unfolded blossoms, and deep in the center of a flaring, two-handed, single-bloomed tiger lily lay G, and the disguise buried his face in the bloom. "Run!" I cried, and G ran around the corner. It was a beautiful day. We drove along a sunny road. I was young and old at the same time. The movie was continuing over my shoulder, and off to our right I saw G run up a long, sloping hill, still put Uncle Sam still following. So small they were against the sky, going outward from us, G neared the top of the hill, and Uncle Sam charged after, far away and small. Uncle Sam loomed over him. Uncle Sam reached down, and his radiating downward power transfigured all that Uncle Sam was except for his head, and all that G was into a slowly but quickly flowering tiger lily, inside which G must have been, for death went grinning into his grimly unfolding, flowering fingers. After we reached the end of the street where the railroad tracks ran to my left, a stretch of green separated from the street, I said, "Now we get him." We ran down the street towards G and Uncle Sam. I was still young and old, but now in my hometown and in a movie watching myself run childishly carefree along the railroad tracks away. G seemed to have gone through a field. I hit Billy Saul Estes, and he looked at me for an instant, young and old. He seemed resigned. I was a citizen in town. The cop locked the glittering handcuffs on right in front of my eyes. "Here is your man," I said to the marshal. And Billy Saul Estes and I were face to face in the newsreel, big people, and he was off to jail. I hated the skin on his face, the slick, immature double chin, and the way his upper lip rode over his lower, and how his teeth were short. He was gone to jail. I had done my duty. Tears in my eyes, I looked across the table at G in the dark kitchen, hoping he knew I had double-crossed Billy Saul Estes for him, would do anything for him, with our eyes on each other. Captain Myers and his date Judy sat across the table from us on the terrace at the country club. Felix and Celia Clayton had invited us to the club for dinner with Myers and his date Judy, and we all sat under the umbrella in the late afternoon sun and talked and drank scotch and looked over the golf course while Judy underlined what a marvelous guy Dr. Patterson was. Everyone knew Dr. Patterson, yet one day he suddenly moved out of town. I looked at my wife as Celia Clayton added from her distraction, "He was really..." I laughed. Judy smiled. "I met him briefly at a party. Right away I saw he was somebody. I saw it." I was looking at her intently because I had gone to school and church with Judy's children and the Patterson's children. Judy's children were married now, and Judy was divorced. Dr. Patterson had been very popular around the church. Celia gestured. "When Fee and I joined the Episcopal Church, we heard about him everywhere we went, and finally we met him. He was so striking, and I was shocked when I heard he'd left town." Judy said, "I've known him for a year." Captain Myers looked at her. "Did you know his wife?" "She was incredible," Judy said. Judy put her hand on her drink. And I asked, "Why they break up?" Felix answered. Felix was a preoccupied man. Patterson was unsure of himself. His practice was down. Judy murmured she didn't know why. Myers asked, "Why would Patterson be unsure of himself? He had been in practice for years." "Yes," Judy said. "He was a very reliable doctor. My wife asked Myers if he was ever unsure of himself, although he was regarded reliable." Myers answered, "Yes. But Patterson seemed different, very sure of himself in a controlled way," my wife said. Myers nodded, "Yes." Myers said, "Patterson kept himself in control. And Myers became introspective, and my wife looked into his introspection. He saw her doing that, and his face became introspective, and my wife looked into... And my wife looked into his introspection. He saw her doing that, and his face opened to himself, seeing himself through my wife's use of her reaction to him. Myers said, A reliable doctor can be an unreliable man. Not for long, my wife said. And later we went to Fee's house, an interesting house. The kitchen was to the left of the front door, the living room was straight ahead, and bedrooms in a den flanked a corridor on the right, down which I walked into the bathroom and at the end and got into swim trunks, drunkenly holding onto the sink and then moving down the corridor, passing the living room, going to the kitchen. I knew where Fee kept his booze. I opened the cabinet, took up the dant, made a highball, and went out to the side porch, down the steps, across the cement, and stepped into the pool as my wife jackknifed off the board, hitting the water to Judy's applause. I paddled across to my wife's bobbing head and cap. She wiped her eyes. She smiled. She asked, "Did you see me?" I said, "Indeed I did." And we swam across to the edge. I put my drink down, and Myers came into the water, hands and head emerging near me. "Terrific," he said. And Felix threw a rubber ball, a duck, and a raft onto the water and dived in after, bobbing up and smiling in his pool. And we threw the ball around, but later when the others were partying inside the house, Judy lay alone on the raft in the shadow of the diving board, and I came to surface beside her and pulled the raft out from beneath her. She came to the surface fuming, and I angrily asked why she had said Maria Patterson was incredible. Judy sneered, "Maria didn't care about Pat, it was the children." I splashed water in her face. No, you mean credible then, because you bring up the familiar thing. Judy asked, "Who cares but me?" I answered, "When Patterson left town, he left it all, including you." "How do you know?" Judy asked. "Because it's familiar," I answered. "Now Murray is dead. So she's incredible. The common call the dead incredible." "That wasn't Pat's fault." "She's dead," Judy said. I said, "It was Pat's fault she died in his life without affecting him." And Judy asked, "Why ruin it? I had good times with him." "Now you think it is you," I said, "but Maria knew Patterson was an exceptional doctor. Your sexuality was familiar stimulus to escape, as his failure within himself to him oddly seemed to stimulate his success. You saw him as a success, and he saw himself as..." My wife later cried at me, "Who do you think that you are? Why did you... What did you say to her? Do you have your deductive shingle out?" I chuckled. I told her Judy was the part of me I knew best and most despised. "It is someone else's life," my wife underlined, her dark eyes fiery, "not yours." "It's a long story," I said. She nodded, "and complicated like the others, yes. As the day Felix's wife Celia was telling her 10-year-old son Jason to sit up straight while I drew him. I said, "Don't listen to her, Jason. Just keep your eyes on the bridge of my nose." Jason's 12-year-old brother George sat behind Jason politely watching me. I had just drawn him. And Celia was pleased and excited because Felix wouldn't like the drawings. He wouldn't understand them. Thus she was vindicated, and her son Jason studied me as I looked at his face. He stood in the distance inside his blue eyes and studied me. George had done likewise. Both boys adept at moving through their self undergrowth over the rug, through invisible mother and father life walls, reflecting images of their childish faces and adult faces and figures, young and old, the whole family rushing into their futures, George and Felix and Celia, yet primarily Jason, so vividly American, so frenzied in his intuitive space, and like his mother's shadows behind her eyes, shadows lurked behind Jason's eyes, and when I saw into the shadows, his face blurred, and behind the bushes I saw a spectral soldier darkly clad in sexuality, and over his shoulder in the distance, at the end of the woods, at the start of the highway of childhood, which Jason was already avoiding, I saw his young figure flying over childhood into his well-dressed, invisible, unbearable future experience to which Jason was already reacting as I drew into his splintered spatial blue eyes, which I knew from history yearned for war. Sound of march of feet, confetti, and music, armies of children marching in time, space away from distracted mommy, preoccupied daddy, to the phallic one-sided frenzy without opposites, as the sleek man in the furniture store where I work, lying slant across his unfinished pink face that is looking to me as he is speaking to me, glancing away from me, he speaks, his waxen fingers strike his chest and fly in front of his puckered waxen face, thrust forward, his trunk tilts, his hipless hips drive his long legs nervously awry, in an aura of pre-nascence, outlines his 30 years, revealing Blake's deadly conjecture, this man at edge before me is one more childishly excitable sadist, lusting for pain and excrement, lips wrapped in a groping circle, sucking and eating his embryonic self, sucking for life on the dark inner outline of existence, walking the floor of the furniture store he sells and speaks his formal and idiomatic hostility in suppressed pop-eyed rage at older women, tall pink boy of wax making out a sales slip, his childish loopy handwriting hardened and pinched and naively decorated by tendril scrawls hanging beneath the sloping unclosed circle letters that curl and wiggle on a downward slant across the lined blue shadowed throat into a darkly warm and bloody place in my experience begun on August 2nd, 1930 by poor people in New York, my father fighting to hold a job, my mother disillusioned, my sister 5 years ahead of me, I began the lifelong unification of separate selves in the dark clockwork of inner and outer worlds. I drew Jason looking out of his doomed eyes. And later one day, Celia told me a story. We sat in the sun by the pool. One day, Jason came in the kitchen, she said. She was doing the dishes, and Jason greeted her in his formal manner. She returned the greeting, and he asked her where her gun was. She asked him why he wanted her gun. He wanted to do some target shooting. He wanted to do some target shooting at the woodpile, he said. She told him her gun was dismantled in the shoebox on the floor of the closet in the den. When Jason faced the closet door, he turned the knob and opened the box, opened the door. He peered at coats and sports equipment. His gaze lowered and focused on the box on the floor. He held his fingers over. He lifted the lid, witnessed the parts of the gun. He assembled it and loaded it and went outside by the side of the house and faced the woodpile. Trees slanted down the hill beyond. He fired into the woodpile and the soldier in the shadow stepped into Jason's brain and turned his face full of lines to the side of the house, the low casement bathroom window. And from 10 feet away, he fired. Celia looked at me distractedly, a pretty girl growing old with staring eyes. The bullet hit the shower tiles a few inches above the hot and cold water spigots. Had she been under her afternoon shower and facing the spigots, it would have the base of her spine, or had she faced the window, Jason would have had his revenge in her womb. The drawings are framed and on the wall. I told Fee, don't try and understand them. Let him hang there. One day you'll come home walking here and they'll be real to you. He was doubtful. A few years later wrote, I was right. And one bright day years before that, I cut across the Patterson's yard on my way into town. I heard my name called. I turned and Maria Patterson gestured from a chair on the lawn. I went to her. She was in a folding chair smoking a cigarette and drinking Coke. Gray eyes looked out from her wide, handsome face. She said, I saw your mother in town the other day. We had lunch together. Did she tell you? I said, yes, mother likes you. Maria smiled and thanked me. She sat forward looking at me. How old are you? I answered, 17 in August. She said, your mother tells me you want to be a writer when you grow up. I nodded. Maria sat back looking at me thoughtfully. Your mother is a wonderful person, she said. She asked me if I knew that. I nodded. She said, not many mothers would, and she underlined dream. She looked at me sharply. I nodded and she said, don't be a writer. Her eyes deepened. Get a job when you grow up. Be a ball player. You're a good ball player. Find a nice girl and get married. Have children. Be a man like other men, okay? Our eyes met, and the last look in her eyes was her reaction to what she saw in mine. She lowered her eyes, and my gaze followed her unfolding reaction. Yet I then felt a little away from me, as though I stood on the lawn, away, looking at me and Maria like they were statues on the grass. Am I forever to be at such lengths from me? From the middle of me where I can look out of to point at me and point back? I sit here nervously watching myself, remembering waking just after dawn. I was 6 years old in Pittsburgh. I went out of the house in my pajamas. I went across the silent, deserted street. I knocked on the screen door of the house across the street and waited. I knocked again and waited until the inside door opened and Freddie's father looked at me, though, through the screen door. I asked him if Freddie was up. No, I asked him, why are you bigger than I am? I am older, he said. I am a man, not what I meant. A slender man with thin face and dark eyes stood in the middle of the street behind me. I peered out of my rear eyes at him while looking up at Freddy's father. I turned toward the man in the street. The street was empty. I recognized him later in the turn of the screw. He comes from existence, not the grave. It was me ahead of myself. I woke in darkness in Florida, hearing my mother murmuring, "Everything is all right." I heard the voices of men in violence and fear on the wind and palm trees. My sister and I sat up in our beds. Oh, I was on the sunny seashore waiting and gazing, dazzled out to sea, going up the pasture to the foot of the cliff of ice and wandering by rivers through forests and jungles of mountains along roads, highways, looking at hills all my life, awake and asleep. Certain if I embraced my peripheral self, I would have me. I was wrong. They are already mine. I am these. They are the separate unity. This face you see is the lifelong image of fate at work in the middle of other lives that outwardly connect in the flesh of the one me. In existence, doomed to be all that I am, which I have always been, as I was born begun, even as if I was someone else perceiving me or him work on the drawing for the display window, flirting with myself or himself. His or my youth, young and old at the same time. I looked across at the drawing as the sketched face rose, becoming a papier-mâché oval standing vertically in front of me, shifting and growing larger to my left above me. Dots in the center of penciled circles took life and glared down at me, and then two pair of eyes appeared on either side of the oval shield with a white line between, black pupils corkscrewed and burned darkly out at me, and violet triangles outlined in black covered the steadily darkening shield. The jungle roared in flames beyond, and the eyes blackly cursed me. I stumbled backwards from her. Animal screamed, and she sent her fiery, double-eyed anathema down upon me. I cowered, growing younger, starting to cry. Her eyes increased their savagery. I fell back, yet rose swiftly to my feet to furiously face that mask of Maria. I cocked my arm and spear finger, my face drawn in anger. I bellowed, I lunged, the letter. I sat up beside my wife. I got out of bed and crossed my loft in darkness, opened my mother's letter and read by moonlight. Friends, neighbors, doctor is her physician. Mrs. is a lot like Maria Patterson used to be, witty and attractive and like her in appearance. Henry James returned Quint to seize his unconscious child, preceptor of the man he would become. He would become his adult and boyhood inner companion, the goddess, the governess, the woman Henry James was, the woman he possessed, the woman he never had. I was depressed. I grinned. I looked introspectively into Felix's swimming pool. "Although I don't mind when you drink," my wife said, "I do mind. But when you're like this," and I felt inferiority approach my life to implicate me within my confusion. But then I saw Judy's imitation of herself, as though she was Patterson's pride, characterized my reaction to me. And my sense of inferiority, realizing I was seeing me across the line, i.e., I wouldn't let me accept my perception of Maria perceiving me. And my dream of Maria's savage mask was my dream of my savage endowment of me within her, which infuriated her, and she would stare me down to hell. I took my wife's hand. We walked. Darling, it is a long story. It is a world I will clearly see. I shook my fist. I must. I was close to inner rightness and violence, a deep, dark, volatile frenzy of true emotion. And I put my fist against my forehead, and my wife touched my fist. I perceived her perceptive touch, sounding a great union of our two great opposite selves. She murmured, "You will."